Hey everybody! Before we get started, just a friendly reminder. You could have already heard this episode over at the Grab Bag Collab Patreon at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. That's the podcasting network I launched with my partner in Pulitzer-winning Amanda Rossman and also Tony Award-winning actor Daisy Egan, whose amazing show Strange and Unexplained is also on Grab Bag Collab now. For $8 a month, you get early, ad-free episodes of Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained, plus several other shows. There's The Catalyst, which I've shared with you before in this feed. There's Dear Daisy, a podcast about secrets. There's Shut the F Up, Nick Lachey, a recap show about Love is Blind with host Daisy and Broadway superstar Ellen Marsh. Plus, we rotate in new limited run shows too and mix in other fun bonuses at the various tiers. We're a profit-sharing network, so we're trying to build something new and innovative over there, and we'd love your support. So please, head on over to patreon.com/grabbagcollab to at least sign up for the free tier so you can decide if we're a community you'd like to join. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. When Bernie Madoff finally confessed what he had done to his wife Ruth and their two grown sons, Ruth had questions. "What's a Ponzi scheme?" she asked. The sons, Mark and Andrew, knew what it was. They also knew in that instant their lives as they had always known them were over. Both sons left their parents' lush Upper East Side penthouse and never spoke to or saw their father again. That very day, December 10th, 2008, they consulted an attorney who explained that if they did not report this immediately to authorities, they would be considered criminal accomplices because it was, in legal terms, a crime in progress. When the call was made, the Securities and Exchange Commission branch chief on the other end said he'd have someone get back to them tomorrow about the alleged $50 million fraud they had referenced. "I don't think you understand," their attorney said. "It's $50 billion, not $50 million. And the world, already in the midst of the darkness of the 2008 financial crisis, got even darker. Over the span of 40 years, Bernie Madoff, a very smart, very accomplished, very revered and honored narcissist, had been running a wealth management outfit alongside his market-making brokerage, the latter a relatively successful Wall Street darling. The more elite and less widely known investment advisory branch, renowned for its astonishing year-after-year yields of 15 to 19%, had never experienced an annual downturn. It had also, strangely, never experienced much wiggle-waggle. A month, maybe, of less impressive returns, but if you graphed it, year after year, it was a straight arrow up. That made Madoff a legend, a wizard, a savant. It also made him a world-class criminal. Because of the hundreds of thousands of trades he had supposedly done for those he represented in that investment advising capacity, not a one actually happened. All the shares, all the options, all were never traded, despite the regular occurrence of monthly statements of the many specific trades having gone out under his name. Bruce Dubinsky, the lead forensic accountant charged by the federal court to unravel the massive fraud, explained.
Bernie Madoff's fraud was not a complex fraud. It involved simply taking people's money, telling them he was going to invest their money, and he never did. So to continue the Ponzi and perpetrate this fraud, he had his handful of soldiers at the investment advisory side of the business create fake trades. It was very easy to create a fictitious trade if you know what it traded for yesterday. It's like going to the horse races and betting on yesterday's horse race. It was just a key punch operation. People sat around and key punched this historical information into the computer to make it look like they bought Amazon a month ago and sold it yesterday at a profit.
And when somebody wanted to withdraw money, Madoff would just use other people's money to pay them. It was not money the market had made for them. It was money another guy had given Madoff to invest for him. The definition of a Ponzi scheme. Eventually, it was determined to be a $65 billion fraud, the largest such scheme to date. Madoff would plead guilty to a panoply of crimes and be forced to pay $170 billion in restitution. He'd also be incarcerated for 150 years in a medium-security federal prison for the crime. It was a hell of a sentence, the maximum allowed. The judge, by law, also had to enumerate it another way, 1,800 months. Was it so stringent because so many were defrauded, their pensions and life savings gone, or because Madoff had broken so many laws, or because of the sheer audacity it took to pull it off? It's hard to say, but Jim Campbell, author of Madoff Speaks, minced no words when he spoke of the man and the crime.
Bernie Madoff ran the biggest criminal enterprise in the history of Wall Street. He was a financial sociopath, a serial financial killer.
Madoff would have to give up his houses in Manhattan, Montauk, and Palm Beach. He'd have to liquidate everything he had to pay the fine. He'd have to go to prison. He had swindled a veritable parade of the world's biggest banks. J.P. Morgan Chase, the Royal Bank of Scotland, Britain's HSBC, the Netherlands Fortis Bank, Bank Austria, Sweden's Nordea Bank, Royal Bank of Canada, UBS, as well as the Steven Spielberg charity, baseball great Sandy Koufax, the owners of the New York Mets, Kevin Bacon, John Malkovich, two law schools, and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel. He'd also taken in some individual investors, synagogues, country clubs, and widows, and a lot of people who should have known better. On March 12, 2009, Madoff pleaded guilty to 11 charges, including securities fraud, wire fraud, money laundering, and perjury. At a sentencing, U.S. District Court Judge Denny Chin made his contempt for Madoff and his actions clear. Quote, "The message must be sent that Mr. Madoff's crimes were extraordinarily evil. This kind of irresponsible manipulation of the system takes a staggering human toll. Mr. Madoff will get what he deserves and will be punished according to his moral culpabilities." End quote. Madoff swore his little scheme started in 1992. Facts show it had been going on for probably four decades. Madoff swore he did not tell his family because he wanted to protect them. It would literally kill them. And he swore he was neither bad nor stupid, just, quote, "a glorified bagman," end quote. Still, what lingers are the questions. How did he do it? Why did he do it? And why did it take 40 years, multiple whistleblowers, five SEC investigations, and a boatload of really smart people who should have known that something wasn't right here for it to finally be revealed? Let's start at the beginning, which is, oddly, a love story between Ruth Alpern and Bernie Madoff, one that began when she was 13 and he was 16. They were kids from Queens who married in 1959. Ruth was 18 by then, over her father's reservations. Saul Alpern thought Ruth deserved a better future than Bernie seemed destined to give her. Madoff's parents had not been particularly successful. A few of his dad's businesses had failed, and his mother had gone back to work to support the family. A bit of an embarrassment in 1950s middle-class suburbia. But Alpern, a very successful accountant, gave Madoff a desk in his Midtown Manhattan office, and from there, his eager son-in-law ran a little over-the-counter stock trading for a handful of family members and friends referred by Saul. They call this affinity investing. People you know trust you, after all, then they refer you to their friends, and so on and so on. This was, mind you, in so-called penny stocks. Small-time, though high-risk stuff, not New York Stock Exchange-caliber stocks like General Motors or Coca-Cola. Not much later, Madoff decided he would do some financial advising. You know, managing people's money. explain New York Times business reporter Diana Enriquez, who followed the story for years and is the author of Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust.
The investment advisory business operated, so far as we can tell, completely under the radar. We know to some extent that it began small. Customers of his, who go back the longest, started with very small nest eggs.
The shift to wealth management made sense to Madoff because, as Campbell explained,
you make the investments for them and try to earn them returns. But you earn fees rather than commissions. It's much more profitable than doing commission-based business.
On May 28, 1962, the market fell 20% and Madoff's clients lost $30,000. Everyone who knew him at the time said Madoff felt terrible about it, and because he wanted, above all else, to be liked and admired, he borrowed that same amount of money from his father-in-law and made good on the losses, returning the money to his investors. But, said Enriquez,
and then he lies to them about what he's done. The outcome of his lies was that he looked like a genius. He looked like an incredible success, a brilliant, brilliant strategist that navigated the worst week in the stock market since 1929 without losing a nickel.
So they kept their money with him as the market recovered. In that same office were two of Alpern's accountants, Stephen Bienes and Frank Avellino. They were enlisted by Madoff to recruit their clients into Madoff's investment advisor ranks. Bienes explained,
"We were only taking a small clip off the top. That's all it was. Couldn't take more. We thought that was the rule. And we never were pigs. That's one thing that kept us going. We were never pigs."
Eventually, both men took home about $10 million a year, thanks to Madoff. Bienes maintained in a 2009 Frontline episode on PBS that he never worked very hard for that money.
"I said, I'm a little too lucky. Why am I so fortunate? And then I came up with the answer. My wife and I came up with the answer. God wanted us to have this. God gave us this."
By the early 1990s, Madoff had 3,000 clients in his wealth management business. The Securities and Exchange Commission rules stipulate you must register as an investment analyst if you have 15 clients. Madoff did not register then, and he would neglect to for the next 30 years. Bienes and Avellino also never registered, even though Bienes claimed he approached Madoff about the need for certification. Madoff refused, he said. The accountants agreed that they operated according to Madoff's rules. They then marketed their own little services as wealth advisors, always funneling the money to Madoff for his use. They got the idea to solicit grouped funds, like pension plans or trusts, and expand to Florida and beyond. But they got a little too slick. In 1992, the two men sent out letters soliciting potential clients, guaranteeing them up to 18% returns in a 100% safe investment plan. Those ridiculous claims got the SEC's attention. When investigators asked the two junior league accountants how much they had raised for investment, their attorney, Ira Sorkin, said he thought the regulators were expecting them to say something like $10 to $15 million. The two men, said Sorkin, looked at each other and said, "Oh, something like $441 million." The SEC pulled the plug on them. The investigative look-in on Madoff's role was less than thorough. By then, he was golden. That was because sometime in the mid to late 1960s, Madoff had gone into the legit market maker business and was getting a lot of respect. He soon moved the family to a big house on Long Island, and Bernie took a seaplane to work every day. Now bear with me, I don't know a lot about this stuff, but Google helped me out here. A market maker is someone or some firm that is always buying securities from sellers and selling securities to buyers. They hold on to them if no one is buying, thus providing liquidity all around. This means that you can trade quickly at a fair price in all conditions. Quoting here, "In turn, this generates confidence in the markets." Meanwhile, Madoff was doing something nobody else was. He, along with his brother Peter, had gone all in on brand new game-changing technology. He, in effect, pioneered digital trading and revolutionized how fast the stock market worked. The brothers used this new tool to allow the processing of massive orders, making and showing trades instantaneously, thus competing on a much higher plane than most all others, attracting big institutional clients, gigantobanks, and all kinds of attention. In 1971, this had the effect of creating the NASDAQ, making a more level playing field for all comers, easing the elite New York Stock Exchange pretty quickly out of business. By the end of 1992, Madoff was doing a full 9% of all trading on the exchange. Killing it was an understatement. Impressing his father-in-law now was a piece of cake. Bernie Madoff had rocketed skyward in ways no one could have predicted. Pretty soon, he became chairman of the NASDAQ, served as the chair of the National Securities Clearing Corporation, as well as chair of its international counterpart and of the National Association of Securities Dealers and the National Business Conduct Committee. Notably, he was a member of all the boards that had to do with ethical trader conduct. You can laugh here. Yes, Madoff wrote the rule book on what was not only legal, but morally right for the industry. I guess the saying, you gotta know the rules to break them, applies here because he is, all the while he's Mr. Big and Mr. Clean, running his shadow business of shuffling money around instead of investing it. He is ostensibly keeping the two businesses, the market maker part and the investment analysis part, separate. The one set of employees wasn't even allowed to mingle with the other set. At the offices of Bernie Madoff Investment Securities, the 19th floor existed for the market makers. The 17th floor was where the dirty work was done, so much so that there was a special passkey to get onto that floor and into that office, and those offices were nothing at all like those upstairs. For starters, the plaque on the 17th floor's Madoff door was not glass, but solid, and it read, Madoff Deliveries. Both floors were in New York's Lipstick Building, so called because its mauve color and its stacked shape made it look like a lipstick case. Upstairs on 19, Bernie, an obsessive compulsive fuss budget, was always straightening the blinds, lining up his state-of-the-art computers so they tilted in the same way, regimenting everything from what plants to what color frames employees could use on their desks. By the way, it was always black or gray. And replacing any piece of carpet the minute anyone spilled anything on it. He also required all desks to be cleared every night before whoever sat there left for the day. The 100 well-dressed people employed up there, by and large, were name school graduates with business and investing acumen who did hundreds of thousands of trades a day and made at least $1 million a year. By the way, if you got married while employed with Madoff, he'd pay the airfare for your honeymoon. Now back on 17, boxes were stacked to the ceiling, papers were everywhere, desks were kind of helter-skelter, ashtrays were full. The printer was a dot matrix thing which ran through cheap paper that was perforated on the sides. The machine that spit out the quote-unquote trades was a 1988 AS400, a mid-range server that mainly was used for data management. You know, the kind you input yourself and manipulate at will and doesn't interface with anything else? The people Madoff chose to work in that room were high school graduates who had been menial workers in their previous jobs. He wanted people he could pay what they considered to be exorbitant money, a few hundred thousand a year, and in return, they would do whatever he told them. They would later say they had little understanding of what they were doing, short of pushing buttons and feeding numbers into spreadsheets. A cardinal rule for them? They never spoke about their jobs. One woman who revered Madoff for the life he had given her had a picture of him on horseback on her desk. Oh, and she also freely used the firm's Platinum American Express for vacations, as did a lot of people, including Ruth Madoff, who would occasionally spend $50,000 a month of other people's money on, well, curtains for her penthouse. Frank DiPasquale, who worked for Bernie from 1975 on, ran the 17th floor and knew what it was doing. He may have been the only one, besides Bernie, who did. His previous job to working for Madoff was at a gas station. Bernie and Ruth had two sons, the aforementioned Mark and Andrew. Both went to great schools, did well, and joined their father in his market maker business, eventually running the 19th floor operation with their uncle Peter. Many times his sons asked him about the other side of the business, the wealth management part, the 17th floor, given that someday they would have to take it over. His younger son Andrew spoke to Morley Safer on a 60 Minutes episode in 2011.
It was always a very similar response. You guys have your business to worry about and let me worry about my business. And the conversation would end there.
It's essentially what he told everybody. Stories abound about how if an investor asked him questions about how he was coming up with these great returns, he'd respond with, "If you don't trust me, I can give you your money back today. We don't have to do business." Former Madoff investor Richard Schwartz, in a Netflix documentary, remembered how his father cherished the chance Madoff gave him to take care of his family.
Originally, it was just my father, my mother, my sister, and myself. Put a certain amount of money in, got a return the next quarter. My father said, okay, let's put another investment in. And now we included my brother-in-law and my wife. And by the time 2008 rolled around, my kids were in it, my nieces and nephews were in it, and some of their kids. So this was my father's pride and joy. It was a legacy for him to provide to his family, and he was extremely proud of it.
And yet, Schwartz continued,
a lot of his procedures and methods struck me as odd. When he supposedly bought stock in all these companies, we wouldn't get confirmations for maybe 2-3 weeks afterwards. We didn't question it, but we certainly didn't get it in a timely fashion. And it was very difficult to communicate with them. Basically, one of the rules we learned early on was he was pretty much the soup Nazi.
Excuse me, I think you forgot my bread.
You want bread?
Yes, please.
$3!
What?
No soup for you.
You're asking too many questions? No soup for you. I'm going to send you your check back. It's exactly the way it was.
Madoff could similarly intimidate and bamboozle regulators and investigators. Four previous times, the SEC had heard complaints or rumors on the street, and they had begun pawing through his records. Each time, Madoff faded the heat. He would show them numbers or accounts, especially prepared by DePasquale, and sling his favorite split-strike conversion explanation at them, and they'd fold. One time he even gave an SEC investigator his investment firm's Depository Trust Company, or DTC code, which facilitates the processing of transactions. If the investigator had followed through, records would show no transactions had ever been recorded. No one checked. Everyone trusted Madoff because everyone else trusted Madoff. Besides, wasn't his accountant always able to confirm that his regulatory filings were in order? Well, yeah, but the firm, if anyone had checked, was one guy in a strip mall in the Borscht Belt who rubber-stamped anything Madoff sent his way. P.S., he was indicted later, too. Anyway, on Monday, October 19th, 1987, when most of the world was shocked as markets everywhere crashed, Asia was first, and the Dow plunged 508 points and investors lost their minds.
This morning, the stock market has been in a free fall.
In trading rooms on Wall Street, there was panic. Sell orders flooded in from big institutional investors, from private investors, from mutual funds. Worried about inflation, rising interest rates, a declining dollar, and huge budget and trade deficits.
Madoff stood apart from the pack as almost everyone was offloading stock and the market-making end of the business. His market makers, by definition, had to keep buying that day. They were up to their asses in orders. Ellen Hales, a longtime trader in Madoff's office, remembered that day.
A market maker is someone who is willing to be the buyer and the seller of last resort. So we were the only ones buying. A lot of firms were not picking up their phones. And I remember very distinctly Bernie yelling, "Pick up the phones. We're not going to be the firm that doesn't pick up the phone."
He survived. His firm and his illegitimate business survived. Now, in later years, as investigators have proved, the two Madoff businesses were not as separate as he had maintained. The firewall he said he kept between them proved porous. It is possible that the money obtained fraudulently actually propped up the market that day. And because Madoff's unique brand of charisma, bullshit, and invulnerability never ran dry, he went on to lead efforts to formulate rules for the market to handle such a crisis in the future. Was he bulletproof? Harry Markopoulos, a securities industry executive and forensic accountant in Boston, had ammunition to test the theory that he was. In 2000, Markopoulos' boss asked him to design a product like Madoff's so they, too, could print money and amaze the crowds. Reverse engineer it, he said. In early 2009, Markopoulos spoke to 60 Minutes' Steve Croft.
He had the patina of being a respected citizen, one of the most successful businessmen in New York, and certainly one of the most powerful men on Wall Street. You would never suspect him of fraud, unless you knew the math.
So the math nerd sat down to work the problem, pencil in hand.
It took me 5 minutes to know that it was a fraud. It took me another almost 4 hours of mathematical modeling to prove that it was a fraud.
Enraged by the size of the fraud, Markopoulos wrote an 8-page memo citing the various red flags he found in 2000. Without getting a response, he submitted more evidence in 2001, 2005, 2007, and 2008. His final memo was more than 200 pages long. Never was it more obvious that the industry overly relied on self-policing and internal compliance, and that the SEC was understaffed and overworked or incompetent. Journalists weighed in with their own questions. In May of 2001, Barron's reporter Aaron Averland wrote a feature entitled online, "Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Bernie Madoff is so secretive, he even asks his investors to keep mum." When Madoff was asked to explain his success to Averland, he told her it was, quote, "a proprietary strategy. I can't go into it in great detail," end quote. In some prospectus the journalist found, Madoff vaguely outlined how it worked, but when three option strategists for major investment banks tried it, it didn't work. In response, Madoff said they just didn't know the formula, or didn't do it right, or didn't have all the facts. To investors, he made it clear that, quote, "if you invest with me, you must never tell anyone you've invested in me. It's no one's business what goes on here," end quote. This was true even when working with people who were managing a large amount of money and should have known better. It was so secretive an operation, it was said you had to know someone to refer you into it. And that was part of the allure. Not everybody could get in. It made for a singular group of people being over-victimized. Because again, this was, at least in the beginning, a group who invested because of their affinity with Madoff. His individual clients were largely Jewish families, Jewish charities, Jewish universities, and Jewish members of the Palm Beach Country Club set, and by extension, everybody those people knew. But that is understating his reach. The first hedge fund that came aboard was run by the Fairfield Greenwich Group. One of their principals had five daughters, each married into wealthy families in different parts of the globe. And their friends had friends, and so on. The cash flowed into Madoff's operation from every continent, and for good reason. All those hedge fund managers were getting rich right along with their clients. The New York Times' Enriquez again.
Consistent returns. But what really appeals to them is something they've never seen before in the burgeoning world of hedge funds. The fee structure was luscious. The rule was 2 in 20.
Let's say you've invested with a typical hedge fund. The hedge fund bros would get 2% of all of your assets invested right off the top. That was considered their fee for managing the fund. On top of that, they would also get 20% of the profits they made for you. Now, usually they'd need to split that with a guy like Bernie Madoff, who was actually the money manager, the guy buying and selling and such. But Madoff didn't make them split that money. Instead of splitting it, the hedge funds got to keep the whole amount, paying Madoff only commissions on the trades he said he made for them. This meant the hedge funds made millions more going with Madoff than they would another money manager. So yeah, the hedge funds liked him. Among them, one well-connected aristocrat and French fund manager named Thierry Magon de la Villouche, who believed so completely in Madoff that he convinced European banks, funds, and a few of the royal families of Europe to hand $1.4 billion to him to in turn hand off to Bernie Madoff. By now, Madoff had 5,000 clients who knew the way Wall Street worked, yet had no digital access to their own accounts, and repeated warnings not to mention his name as their fund manager. Surely, they knew. They would swear they didn't. When Markopoulos' associate Frank Casey tried to alert Villouche that Madoff might be a fraud, the Frenchman responded,
"He can't be. I've got all my money with him. I've got most of my family's money with him. I've got almost every royal family that I know has got the money with him." So he says, "We really have done our work, Frank. You just don't have all the facts."
Casey, a risk analyst, said he figured it just wasn't fathomable.
There's always that potential, that one little potential that you've got a rocket scientist, an Einstein here.
In early October 2008, Einstein failed to show. Due to increasing consumer debt and the unprecedented growth of subprime loans being made to borrowers with bad credit and high risk of default, banks bought those loans, and when defaults began, banks panicked. The Federal Reserve even loaned AIG, a multinational finance company, over $100 billion to bail them out. Still, the stock market began a record decline. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1,874 points, or 18.2%, doing record-breaking volume, its worst weekly decline ever. Even the Standard & Poor's 500 fell precipitously. Madoff's investors needed their money back, and he didn't have enough money to pay them. In order to understand how Madoff used to make up the occasional shortfall, let's just say he had friends with money. For years, Madoff had worked with a small group of impossibly wealthy men who had likely figured out what he was doing and decided to game it for themselves. That is, Bernie would call them up and ask for, quote, more investment from them, end quote, say a couple hundred million dollars, and they would pony up. Bernie could then issue withdrawal checks as if nothing was awry. So these men, known collectively by Madoff and later by the courts as the Big Four, knew they could withdraw as much as they wanted, when they wanted, at all times. In excess, it turned out, than the considerable amount they had put in. They could also ask for tax favors. Say they needed to lower their annual tax bill. They'd ask the dozen folks on Madoff's 17th floor to give them some appreciable losses on paper. Done. And when those men needed cash on hand, they'd withdraw it from the same sad sack of other people's money. Who would Madoff complain to? A nasty word for this is blackmail. The Big Four are not common household names, but one of them, Jeffrey Pickauer, was the largest beneficiary of the fraud. So much so that when the restitution phase was done, while he had only put in $1 billion into the enterprise, it was found that he had withdrawn more than $7 billion, which meant he was forced to forfeit $7.2 billion in restitution, the largest such forfeiture in American judicial history. Now, you need to know that when Madoff came asking for money, nothing was explicitly stated. That's not how the game worked. Instead, because no one acknowledged what the truth was, Madoff would try to sell them on further investment to bring confidence back to the market or to look ahead to future returns. In late 2008, he got a few big commitments of $50, $100, $250 million, but coming up with $7 billion is harder than it looks. By the morning of December 10th, Madoff knew he was not going to hold off those who wanted their money from their non-existent accounts anymore. He began writing checks. They totaled $173 million, ostensibly as early bonuses, doling out the last of his cash to his employees, as well as family and friends. His sons together went to him and asked him what was going on. They had seen the frenzy. They wanted to know what was up. Madoff called his wife and said he and the boys were coming home to talk.
Thank you.
been told by their father that his investment business was one big lie, Mark and Andrew Madoff called the SEC to report their father's crime. The next day, Bernie Madoff answered the door to his home when the FBI came calling, asked if there was an innocent explanation for what they'd been told. Madoff said there was not. A world full of people who believed in him and had given him $65 billion of their dollars to work with sat stunned. Many of them suddenly horribly broke. Saturday Night Live tried to poke some fun at it in this bit featuring Fred Armisen as Madoff trying to reach old friends to invite them over for the Super Bowl.
Another machine? Honestly, either no one in New York is home or I am one unpopular fellow.
You might notice the laughter in the audience was uncomfortably tepid. On December 12th, Madoff's assets were frozen. His sons refused to sign to guarantee his $10 million bond. Forced to choose between her husband and her sons, Ruth remained with a man to whom she'd been married for 51 years, despite the evidence that he had multiple affairs and had lived a lie. Madoff never fought the charges, saying repeatedly that he was amazed he got away with it, that he figured he'd been caught a few times, that it all happened because people are greedy. Now, it can be easy to think of white-collar crimes in terms of just dollar signs, but make no mistake, people were hurt in this mess. People like Ian Tierman, who was 90 years old and 25 years into his retirement when he found out he was flat broke.
Tierman took a job at a local grocery store after losing his entire life savings, more than $700,000, to disgraced Wall Street financier Bernie Madoff.
Then there was 55-year-old Charles Murphy, a hedge fund executive.
This Wall Street executive, who once had the world on a string but lost billions to Madoff, jumped to his death in an apparent suicide.
Then there was the Frenchman Villouche. 3 days before Christmas, the former Madoff ride and die slit his wrists and slowly bled to death. Bernie Madoff's sister and brother-in-law, Sandra and Marvin Wiener, lost millions of dollars too. It would haunt them for the rest of their lives, which ended in 2022 when Sandra fatally shot her husband and then herself in their Florida home. Mark Madoff's end came much earlier. On the second anniversary of his father's arrest in 2010, Mark hanged himself from a beam in his home. His suicide note read, quote, "Bernie, this is what happens when you destroy your sons by your life of deceit. Fuck you, Bernie." End quote. Madoff's younger son, Andrew, died September 3, 2014, of lymphoma. Both sons' last years were spent being hounded by their father's victims, the media, and the courts. Andrew spoke openly and apologetically about the fraud, but never in his father's defense. Bernie Madoff was, as I said, sentenced to 150 years in prison. He served at the federal facility in Butner, North Carolina, until his death April 14, 2021. He was 82, maintaining until the end that the banks knew what he was doing all along. The people who worked to unravel it did well. The forensic accountant, Bruce Dubinsky, worked on it for years. He made $750 an hour. The lawyer still responsible for finding restitution dollars from those who profited makes $850 an hour. Which adds up. Irving Picard's firm has now made more than $1 billion in fees. So why'd Madoff do it? Truth was, he said repeatedly, he didn't know. He said, maybe I just wanted to please people. Others tend to think he loved being the whiz, to be forever revered as this guy who had beat the system he said he despised. In reality, he did it because he could. The story of Bernie Madoff will forever be about not only his fraud, but of the massive failure of a system that thrived on saying it policed itself to be one that couldn't or wouldn't or just didn't. The Madoff Victims Fund has, to date, recovered 91% of fraud losses, clawing back $4.221 billion and repaying those funds directly to 40,843 petitioners in 127 countries. The people who do this for a living have made copious lists of what Wall Street and investors have learned since the scandal. They tell us that the SEC is not a cop, that self-regulation is no regulation at all, that buyers should beware, The list goes on and on. But really, the lesson is this. Crime can pay. In some cases, for a very long time. To research this story, journalist and writer Amy Wilson read New York Times reporter Diane Enriquez' The Wizard of Lies and Jim Campbell's Madoff Talks, uncovering the untold story behind the most notorious Ponzi scheme in history. And she watched a lot of TV news, documentaries, and even a Robert De Niro movie about the case. By the way, that was called Wizard of Lies, and reporter Enriquez played herself in the film. And Amy read the Barron story, as well as the May 2001 story by Michael Okrent in the Mar Hedge, a newsletter. She also adds that she's old, so she remembers some of this too. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.